Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Today on the show, ICE arrests in Wyoming are up by 136% since President Trump took office. We look at how ICE is detaining people in Teton County.
They're coming to the jail and then they're leaving.
We'll hear about a high alpine lake in the southern end of the Wind River Range. It's surrounded by pristine wilderness.
Yet at the same time, it was the highest concentration of this fecal bacteria sampled.
The Natural History Museum in Cody is putting together a bison skeleton with the help of beetles, the bugs, and the band.
Here comes bison, doo-doo-doo-doo. Here comes bison, and I'd say it's all bone.
Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Next time on The Modern West. 5 years ago, a northern Arapaho judge was sent to prison. Now, she helps keep Wind River residents from going back into custody. It all traces back to a landmark Supreme Court case.
Her story inspires me so much, you know. It makes me want to do better, you know, because it can be done.
I am what I choose to become. It's part 7 of The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. The Wyoming Freedom Caucus took charge of the State House in the last legislative session. And with new leaders comes a new focus on faith, according to Jesse Rubino, the Wyoming State Director of the caucus.
I would say that the shared faith in Jesus amongst the Freedom Caucus and our conservative allies in the Wyoming House and Senate doesn't just drive the legislative priorities that the members have, it drives everything that they do.
That was reflected in the winter months.
Oh Lord my God.
A hymn to open the session.
Lord, we just come before you and we just invite you into this place.
Prayers Lord, before committee meetings.
Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Bills to expand freedom and protect expression of religion. Jeremy Haraldson is both a Freedom Caucus lawmaker and a pastor from Wheatland. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements went to his church to hear how his political and religious lives intersect.
Inside Impact Ministries, there's a coffee shop, an office full of hunting trophies, and a sanctuary where Haraldson preaches to his congregation from a stainless steel pulpit he built.
There's two avenues of church in America right now. There's an avenue of church in America, in my opinion, that has taken the Word of God and perverted it. Right? We don't call sin sin anymore. Well, guess what? Sin's sin. But we're going to take, and we're just going to water this down. Why? Because we'd rather it be seeker-friendly than hardline. How many people...
After the service, kids stream by, families stand around chatting. Impact is an Assembly of God church. That's a denomination of Pentecostal Christianity. More than a decade ago, Haraldson attended a different Assembly of God church in town.
There was a pastor came into that church that was from South Africa and just had a very much a different viewpoint on things that, I mean, he didn't understand the culture of Wyoming. He didn't understand a cowboy culture.
So he and others in the church split off to plant their own, with more of an emphasis on going out into the community.
Like, I've got a 150-foot American Ninja Warrior course that I set up for kids. We do a lot of crazy things that are outreach-based.
He leads a shooting sports program, too. His wife, Lori, is a worship leader. 4 of his 7 siblings go to church here.
So we're already addressing this bill that was not our
bill. Back during the legislative session, Freedom Caucus leaders in the House, including Haraldson, held a press conference at the Capitol. He talked about the idea of separation between church and state. He said, in his view, the firewall was only meant to go in one direction.
It is not the government's role or job to dictate to the church its function or role, but it is the role of the church to dictate to the government its function and role.
In order to keep churches from weighing in on politics, Haraldson says the political left has distorted the founding fathers' intentions.
They had an idea that there should be a separation of state and church, but not church and state.
Elizabeth Cavell with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a nonprofit that promotes non-theism, differs with Haraldson on that interpretation.
both our founders and our courts have understood the First Amendment to embody a principle of secularism, which means separation between religion and government, both ways.
Cavell specializes in constitutional law.
Those principles were written about a lot by the framers of the Constitution, not just Thomas Jefferson, but James Madison. They were embodied in the religious freedom statutes in colonial Virginia, and which was the inspiration for our First Amendment.
Haroldson says he views his religious and political jobs as being two sides of the same coin.
I don't compartmentalize my life. If I'm in the legislature, I'm a pastor at the legislature. And if I'm in the pulpit, I'm also a politician in the pulpit.
Earlier this month, the IRS broke with precedent to say that houses of worship can endorse political candidates without losing their tax-exempt status. Haroldson says the move by the agency is vindicating.
Really, at the end of the day, they are responsible for First Amendment violations, in my opinion, First Amendment violations for an extended period of time.
He says he doesn't tell his parishioners how to vote, but he does tell them how he's going to vote.
It's never stopped me personally from being very bold from the pulpit about political things, because I've said from the very beginning, if they want, they can make me their first example.
Back at Impact, Haroldson says the plan is to build a new community center for the church to meet in and add four new pastors to the lineup. He says the moral fabric of Wyoming is based on scripture. And if residents of the state don't agree,
if you don't like how someone's governing you, replace them.
You?
Sure, replace me. But I can tell you right now, about 80% of this community believes how I believe.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements in Wheatland.
ICE arrests in Wyoming are up by 136% since President Trump took office. That's according to new data obtained from ICE by UC Berkeley. Sweetwater, Laramie, Carbon, Campbell, and Natrona counties have all entered into agreements with ICE to help with local arrest and deportations. As Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry reports, even though Teton County isn't officially cooperating with ICE, there's been a rise in transfers to the federal agency there as well.
Rosie Reed runs the Wyoming Immigrant Advocacy Project in Jackson. She's seen this trend firsthand.
ICE is coming to pick people up in a timely fashion every single time right now.
And as of the spring, that's new.
That 100% of people who enter the Teton County Detention Facility who don't have immigration status are placed on an immigration hold.
Before March, Teton County Jail didn't always honor detainer requests. That's when ICE asks jails to give the agency more time to pick people up. That was in large part because ICE didn't often send officers the 5 hours from Casper to Jackson in time. The sheriff had also worried that longer holds could be challenged in court and deemed unconstitutional. After pressure from lawmakers, he reversed course. Matt Carr is the county sheriff. He says ICE is opting for jail pickups over raids.
They're coming to the jail and then they're leaving.
Before the second Trump administration, those arrested without legal status in Teton County didn't always end up with ICE. Now that the federal agency has upped its pickup capacity, Carr says it happens
every single time.
From March to early July, for instance, ICE took 51 people into custody. Earlier this year, that number was closer to zero.
If our sheriff were not to be honoring those detainers without judicial signatures on them, ICE would be forced to go find those people in the community if they wanted to take them into custody.
Reed says people are mostly winding up in jail after traffic stops with minor infractions.
Really minor speeding, like 3 miles an hour above the speed limit. Cracked windshields are becoming like a pretty common reason for traffic stops lately, is what I've noticed.
Under Biden, ICE prioritized felonies. But now with Trump, minor misdemeanors like these are enough. And a new state law will likely turn more traffic stops into more arrests. As of July 1st, it's illegal to drive in Wyoming with a license if you haven't been admitted legally, even if you're coming from one of the 19 states where licenses are issued to non-citizens. How officers around the state will enforce this law is still up in the air, according to the chief of the Highway Patrol, Colonel Tim Cameron. Let's say someone without legal status in the U.S. gets pulled over by a trooper. To ask about status, he says,
the trooper would have to be able to show that, one, they had a non-resident alien driver's license, and they were not legally admitted into the United States.
Some licenses have the words, quote, not a citizen, printed on them.
So they would then have probable cause.
Then from there, there's a lot of discussion as to how troopers move forward.
Trooper would make a call to their watch center number, and ICE would run them through.
If the driver has a criminal warrant and isn't a citizen, then
ICE may say, we'll be there in 10 minutes. Or ICE may say, please get some information and provide to us about where they are living, where they're going, those kind of things.
Or officers could
arrest them, transport them to whatever the local jail would be, and serve that warrant, just like we do any other warrant.
Cameron emphasizes that a trooper could also just write a citation, send that information to ICE, and release them.
Typically how that goes.
He can only speak for how the highway patrol will deal with the law. The local law enforcement are still required to have reasonable suspicion before asking about status. If they don't, here's where critics say the new law could lead to cases of racial profiling or discrimination. That's illegal.
I think it's a great point that they've made, but that's why I think it's also incumbent upon our agency, the WHP, to make sure troopers understand the constitutional ramifications, specifically the Fourth Amendment has not changed.
Reed is one of those critics.
The harder we make it for non-citizens to live in this town or in this county or in this state, the greater the likelihood is that they'll leave.
She's concerned about civil rights violations and the removal of community members.
It feels so futile to try and capture the reasons why immigrants are such an important part of this place, from linguistic diversity and our kids learning from each other about cultural differences and what that does to their worldview.
That loss, she says, can't be summed up in numbers or headlines. For KHOL News, I'm Jenna McMurtry.
The new administration has proposed a lot of changes for managing wildfires. Up next, we hear about another one, rapid suppression. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces. If you're in the Cheyenne area, join Wyoming Public Media reporters for some coffee and conversation. Share feedback, give us a news tip, or just get to know us. Join us from 8 a.m. until 11 on Thursday, July 24th at the Cheyenne Botanic Gardens. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadalska. Last week, we talked about a big change coming for how wildfires on federal public land are managed. Namely, President Trump wants to consolidate federal firefighters into a single agency. This week, we're looking at another proposed change. The new U.S. Forest Service chief is calling for the rapid suppression of wildfires this summer. That may sound prudent, especially if fires are burning near communities, but it raised eyebrows among some who closely study fire policy. They worry it may signal a return to an aggressive posture that has been linked to growing wildfire severity. The Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse has more.
To understand the context of the letter, we need to go back nearly 100 years to another letter whose impacts are still being felt. In the mid-1930s, U.S. Forest Service Chief Ferdinand Silcox wrote that, quote, fast, energetic, and thorough suppression of all fires in all locations was to be the agency's goal, ideally within the first work period. And if that didn't happen, he continued, before 10 o'clock of the next morning. This was the origin of what would become known as the 10 a.m. policy.
We know that decades of fire suppression and not sort of allowing fire to have much of a role in the landscape has led to greatly increased fuel loads, especially in types of forests that historically had fire pretty routinely.
That's forest scientist Mark Kreider, who was the lead author of a paper last year that identified the suppression bias. The paper argues that low and moderate intensity fires are easier to extinguish, resulting in a bias toward, quote, higher intensity burning occurring under extreme weather.
Through this suppression bias, you know, we're taking those inherent increases from climate change and fuel accumulation, and we're sort of tacking on an extra bump in severity.
That's why he read sections of Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz's recent letter of intent on this year's season with concern. We will make appropriate risk-informed efforts to fully suppress small fires before they become large, complex incidents to ensure we can protect lives, property, valuable timber, and natural resources, it reads. It is critical that we suppress fires as swiftly as possible. To Kreider, that last line was reminiscent of the 10 a.m. policy, which was formally abandoned in the 1970s in favor of an approach that recognized fire's ecological role. Kreider agrees that suppression has a role to play in protecting homes, but worries about the implications of trying to quickly extinguish all blazes.
I think it will increase risk in the future. I think this is a case of addressing short-term risk without adequate kind of consideration given to the long-term risk.
In response to a request for comment, a Forest Service spokesperson told the Mountain West News Bureau that Americans expect the agency to always prioritize saving lives and property. Firefighters must be fully focused on wildfire suppression during the busy part of wildfire season, they continued. Prescribed fire and managing naturally ignited fire are critical to reducing wildfire risk and remains our focus outside of peak wildfire season. Schultz's letter itself discusses lowering wildfire risk and fuels reduction work, as well as so-called potential operational delineations, which Kreider calls great science-based tools. They can allow fires to safely burn and do much of the ecological and fuels work of prescribed fire. Here's prominent wildfire historian Stephen Pine on what he called a very carefully crafted letter.
When I first heard about it, indirectly hearsay, I said, oh my gosh, it's a 10 a.m. policy coming back. It is not.
He noted that it opens with a strong emphasis on firefighter safety and later says that direct attack on fires will be done only when it's safe and feasible to do so. He called those escape clauses from the seemingly hard-nosed focus on suppression.
So it allows other kinds of options, even under a suppression policy.
It would be probably about the dumbest thing we could do from a fire management perspective to go back to the 10 a.m. policy. I mean, it's the precise reason we're in the position we're in.
That's Matthew Hurto, director of the Center for Fire Resilient Ecosystems and Society at the University of New Mexico.
The systems that we started excluding fire from 100, 150 years ago, they don't exist anymore, right? We've got fragmented landscapes with houses and communities. And the chief's letter acknowledged the fact that we've got to do suppression in some of those areas because we've got the fuel buildup and the like.
But it also acknowledges, he argues, that there are places where we need to allow fire to burn. The goal, Hurto says, ought to be to carry out enough prescribed burning and other efforts to make sure the wildfires that inevitably come are easier to manage.
Ideally, what we see is a fire management budget that's equivalent to the suppression budget.
With sufficient sustained investment in restoring fire to the landscape, he says the need for suppression would eventually diminish, though never go away completely. But suppression efforts are also going to keep contending with the rising temperatures and drought that climate change brings, he says.
Suppression, like if we invest whole hog in it right now, it's maybe we increase the effectiveness a hair, but we're going to start truly losing that battle.
As bad as this fire season is likely to be, he says, the chance that the next will be worse is pretty decent. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
And now we head to a current wildfire in Arizona. The persistent Dragon Bravo wildfire started earlier this month on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. It's already destroyed dozens of buildings, perhaps none more iconic than the Grand Canyon Lodge. It's already destroyed dozens of buildings. Perhaps none were more iconic than the Grand Canyon Lodge, which greeted visitors from around the world for decades. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Michelle Marisco has this remembrance.
Flagstaff's Helen Ranney has hiked throughout the world, and this place, and particularly the North Rim, touched her soul. She jokes that her son says he left for college when his mom left home. She had accepted a job on the South Rim and moved there from Phoenix with the canyon less than a mile from her front door.
The lodge is just so unique, you know. It's kind of this place. At the South Rim, it's nice, you know, you walk along the rim, but you can't finish up a rim-to-rim hike and get some sort of beverage and go out on the porch like you can at the North Rim. You go out on the porch and you sit down with people from all over the world and you're right on the edge.
She hiked and backpacked the Grand Canyon so many times that she lost count 20 years ago.
You put your feet up on the rock wall sitting in those chairs and you're looking, you know, into the canyon and a much closer view than we can on the South Rim. It's much more intimate.
Tom Myers works as a physician at the South Rim and has authored a book about his experiences hiking the length of the Grand Canyon, The Grandest Trek. He shares a very special memory of the Grand Canyon Lodge and has hiked through what he deems his favorite landscape on Earth for more than half a century.
When I got married in 1988, I told my wife, hey, this is the most amazing place on Earth, and the most spectacular architectural building on the planet. Let's spend our honeymoon there.
He had only recently returned to the lodge this past May and shares this visceral memory of architect Gilbert Underwood's choice of massive windows looking out over the Grand Canyon.
My God, you felt like you were in heaven on earth.
Robert Steeb is editor of Arizona Highways magazine.
When I heard the news, you just don't think something like that's going to happen. You start lamenting the loss of the trees when you see these fires break out. It's so rare to lose a national treasure like a lodge in a national park.
Arizona Highways published a story about the lodge's original opening in the late 1920s, shortly after the famous magazine launched.
When you put it into the perspective of the flooding in Texas and the other things that are happening around the world, you know, losing bricks and mortar and pine trees, you know, is nothing like that. But when you think about it in the perspective of how many lives have been changed, there were people that have lived up there and worked up there for a very long time. The North Rim was part of their life.
The lodge emerged in 1937 from the area's native Kaibab limestone after the original lodge burned down a few years earlier. Helen Ranney hopes the same stone can be used to renew the lodge again.
I don't know that it'll be the same. Maybe it'll be better. Maybe it will be better, but I think it's going to be a long time before that happens.
Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
That story comes to us via Mountain West News Bureau Associate, KJCZ, and its Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Arizona. Ever wonder how a wildlife skeleton at a natural history museum is put together? Well, stick with us. You'll learn how up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Camila Kadelska. A quick warning, for the next 5 minutes, we're going to hear a story that includes descriptions of preparing an animal skeleton that can get a little graphic. The Draper Natural History Museum is reassembling a bison that is going to be part of a major exhibition opening next year. For months, staff, volunteers, and flesh-eating beetles have been cleaning the bones to prepare to put them back together again. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats went behind the scenes, starting at the Draper Natural History Museum Lab, to see what goes into getting the bones ready.
The skin is very thick, and I am trying to follow the contour of the bone as opposed to skin it and then get down to the meat.
Susan Bishop skillfully moves her knife around the bison's eye socket as she peels the skin away from the skull.
It's a challenge, and nobody gets to see, or very few people get to see, what a bison skull looks like.
Bishop is a volunteer. She says part of the challenge is the insulated skin layer beneath the fur that keeps bison warm in the winter. It's about half an inch thick and squishy. She hands me some gloves and the scalpel. We just sharpened the knife, and I am trying to pull away the tissue above the eye, and I'm struggling to even pull any of it back. Whew, man, this is hard work.
And that's also why we have a variety of different knives. So yep. You're using this one here, which kind of has that hook on the top.
Curator Corey Inko explains that people can only do so much when it comes to cleaning the bones. Articulating or cleaning a skeleton has multiple steps. He says the next part relies on furry insects.
Beetles consume all of that soft tissue inside, just leaving behind that porous, spongy-like skeletal tissue in the nasal cavity.
About 6 months after the lab day with the volunteers, I met up with assistant curator Amy Phillips.
Okay, so we're headed down to the lab, and what are we doing here?
We're going to grab the bison skull from the bottom of freezer 2, put it on a cart, and take it to the beetles.
I saw you just take it by the horns.
Yeah. It's the best way to hold it is by the horn cores. So now we've got our bison, and he's ready to go into the bugs.
Okay, let's take him out there.
We head outside of the museum to a shed. The curators call it the Beetle Bungalow. Inside, there's a poster of the band The Beatles and two aquarium-like tanks full of bugs.
So here's our skull that's been partially cleaned by volunteers, and so we're gonna put the whole thing into the beetle colony. So it's basically like a big birthday cake for the bugs.
Phillips gently sets the skull into the tank. Some of the larvae are millimeters in size, while the older beetles are about the size of a Tic Tac. This variance in size allows the beetles to get into all the nooks and crannies.
Because we want to rebuild the skeleton, we're going to be sawing into, you know, and putting wires where the bison's tendons would be. And so it's helpful to have the bones really clean because the glue and the adhesives that we use won't stick if there's fats or, you know, anything on them.
Phillips says spending time with the bison skull, you start to appreciate what bison actually do on the landscape.
It has like this big heavy head and they use it for clearing snow in the winter time. It helps them, you know, as they dig through vegetation to get to what they want to eat.
Anko hopes that when the public gets to see all of the bones fit together, it'll spark their curiosity. How does a bison move? And why do they have such a big hump on their back?
You think all of us at some point have had building blocks, Lincoln Logs, or Legos to put together, and we got to see how things got to snap in place, and together many small pieces make something much larger. And in the same way, to be able to see that in the context of a skeleton, it allows them to put some of these concepts of engineering at play with nature.
After the beetles finish their job, the bones get degreased in a bath of ammonium and then soaked in hydrogen peroxide for a light whitening. For now, Anko says the bugs work better when they're sung to.
Here comes bison, do-do-do-do. Here comes bison, and I'd say it's all bone.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Olivia Weitz at the Center of the West in Cody.
The public can come and watch and ask questions as staff and volunteers work with Lee, the Bone Men Post, to reconstruct the bison skeleton. That's at the Draper Natural History Museum in Cody from August 4th through the 15th. Wyoming has one of the poopiest lakes in the country. That's according to water sampling data recently released by the EPA. Journalist Mike Kajmiral with WildFile recently reported on this. He spoke to Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan.
Mike, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be talking about poopy lakes, Caitlin.
Well, so the one that we're going to talk about, Lonesome Lake in the Cirque, I mean, I know you and I have both spent time back there. And it's kind of been an open secret that this lake has problems, but then seeing this data definitely, I don't know, it was a little shocking to me.
Yeah, to me, the data on the fecal bacteria that the EPA sampled, it's called Enterococci, it like totally jaw-dropping, head-turning because of the setting, right? It's like this like amazing place along the Continental Divide with like snowfields and 12,000 foot mountains and crystal clear water in the setting where, you know, I think people would rightfully presume that it's safe and clean. And then yet at the same time, it was the highest concentration of this fecal bacteria sampled anywhere in the country out of almost a thousand samples the EPA took out of lakes in urban areas, you know, in farm country. It turned out to be 384 times the concentration that the EPA would advise is safe for like submersive recreational activity, in other words, like swimming. And that one sample back in August 2022 was absolutely shocking.
And I, you know, you said one sample back in 2022. It sounds like they're going to do some more sampling this summer. I mean, how worried should people be about this right now if they're planning to go into the Cirque this summer?
You know, the environmental regulators that I interviewed for my reporting, they didn't put a ton of weight into the number just because it was one sample. And one sample is just like one snapshot in time. But all that being said, it's been an open secret for a really long time. All you got to do is Google it, that Lonesome Lake is not a safe place to certainly get water from for drinking, even if you're filtering it. You know, swimming would be risky. You know, if you accidentally ingest a little bit of water, it could make you sick because there's just essentially the constituents of feces, likely human feces, given the amount of use there, that are making their way into the lake.
And so for your story, you backpacked in there.
Yeah. I mean, when I was talking to my editors, I said, like, my first instinct is I want to go in there and, you know, hell, like this problem, we think the likely source of the problem is people pooping, right? And so it was a pretty weird reporting in Denver, but I went and was like, if I had to poop right now, where would I go? And so I went off the trail, you know, dropping down to the lake. I'm like in the Cirque and, you know, looked for some tree stands. You know, it's there's not that many trees when you're higher in the Cirque. So once you get down to the tree line, I'm sure a lot of people are like, I want some privacy. And I didn't spend much time there at all. I didn't count the minutes, but I found what was very clearly, at least I stopped counting at 7 because it felt like a weird exercise, but 7 piles of like shallow buried poop at peak use in early mid-August. There's 400 people going through a week. And so, you know, what percentage of those people have to poop? And what percentage of them, you know, are burying it just a few inches under the soil? And then that whole basin gets socked in with snow and it all melts. And even if you're abiding by the best practices and burying it, I think it's kind of unavoidable that a lot of the biomass you are leaving behind ends up ultimately in Lonesome Lake. And I think that's the problem.
And so everything's melting down into that lake, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. So, but when you hiked in, you saw people jumping in?
Right at the outflow where that river comes out of Lonesome Lake, there was a big group from Utah, and in the process of chatting with them, 12 miles into the backcountry, they airdropped me a video of one of the group doing a spectacular belly flop into the water of Lonesome Lake. And, you know, when he did it, he had no idea, which is why this, in my opinion, why this story is important, because, you know, in an ideal scenario, there'd be signage or some way for people to know that this probably isn't a safe body of water to jump into. Currently, there's not. And so, you know, that guy, it's not like he was being reckless. He just had no idea.
Going forward this summer, sounds like the best thing to do would be to not really be involved with that lake.
To err on the safe side. You know, I threw a call to the Great Outdoor Shop in Pinedale and just asked, what do you tell people if they're going to Lonesome Lake? And the gentleman who answered the phone, he said, you know, I tell people absolutely do not drink out of Lonesome Lake. I tell people absolutely do not swim in Lonesome Lake.
Just like on a broader scale, when we're thinking about more and more people are coming to visit the Winds, I mean, you know, that it's kind of ramping up over there. Do you think this is something that could become a larger problem in lakes in the Wind River Range?
I mean, I'll just say that I would not personally jump into like Island Lake. I would not jump into the most like heavily used lakes in the Winds based on what I've learned about the situation at Lonesome Lake, even if there's not data.
What are possible solutions? I mean, there's some areas where I know people have to pack their poop out. I mean, but how enforceable would that even be if something like that happened for this area?
You know, you could require that. Shoshone National Forest could require that. You could say, if you poop in the Cirque of the Towers, you got to put it in a wag bag and you got to pack it out. But it does sound quite challenging to enforce. You know, a lot of the issue also just traces to high use, and there is maybe a world that a lot of Wyoming residents don't want to imagine where there are limits and permits to go to the most traveled portions of a place like the Winds that exists, where there's a lot more people in places like Colorado. And I think that it's Wyoming is really special because we don't have that in a lot of places. But, you know, this situation points to maybe we need it sometimes, not just for the health of the landscape, but for our own health.
We're still in the heat of summer. I'm sure people are planning backpacking trips. Any best practices pooping in the wilderness, things to keep in mind?
My understanding is, you know, to dig a hole as deep as you can possibly dig and cover it up and make it the earth you put on top as compact as possible.
And generally, I mean, like, be trying to not be super close to bodies of water.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, Mike, this is not the first time you have come on here to talk about lakes. We, the listeners might remember last fall, you told us about a story you did on Little Soda Lake outside of Pinedale. It had turned red, like a deep red wine red. And it was a little unclear as to why. Do we have any updates on that?
So I did hear right when the ice came off the lake remained like this striking deep shade of red, but pretty quickly that abated. But Little Soda Lake became the first lake in the state of Wyoming in 2025 to have a cyanobacteria advisory, also known as blue-green algae, can be quite unsafe to ingest. So they are still kind of probing, is my understanding, to figure out what is the cause of the lake turning red. But in the meantime, just like Lonesome Lake, don't go in Little Soda Lake. Probably not the best idea at this time.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks so much for talking to us about the lakes in the Wind River Range and Pinedale area.
Happy to talk anytime. Thanks, Caitlin.
We'll link to Mike's reporting on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Tribal nations are using mobile healthcare clinics to help increase access to care. More on that on Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
If you're in the Cody area, join Wyoming Public Media reporters for some coffee and conversation. Share feedback, give us a news tip, or just get to know us. Join us from 8 a.m. to 11 on Tuesday, July 29th at Rawhide Coffee downtown. Welcome back to Open Spaces. Some tribal nations are among the most remote communities in the country, and the rural healthcare shortage has hit them especially hard. But some have found a solution: doctor's offices on wheels. On the Wind River Reservation, three mobile clinics park at schools and drive around the community to offer care. But today, we're heading to Nevada to hear how one tribe uses a similar solution. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel takes us there.
It's a clear morning in Lovelock, Nevada, a small desert town about 90 miles northeast of Reno. It's also home to the Lovelock Paiute tribe, which has a 20-acre reservation on the edge of town. I'm at a tree-shaded park, where the tribe is hosting its annual health fair. There's live music, jewelry vendors, information booths, and food trucks. There's also a vehicle that looks like a large blue and white motorhome, idling on the edge of the park. But inside are two patient rooms and a center lab with a blood draw station. It's a mobile health clinic brought here by the Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe, located about an hour away. Gabriel Bourne just stepped out of the vehicle.
Having access to this, I was able to get some shots I needed and, you know, that I should probably had a long time ago, but didn't get.
Time and travel are the biggest barriers, he says. Bourne's a Fallon Paiute Shoshone member, but he lives in Lovelock, so seeing a physician in Fallon is a 2-hour round trip. So when Bourne, who hadn't been to the doctor in more than a year, realized he was steps away from a mobile clinic, he took full advantage.
I'm able to get my eye appointment, which I've needed glasses for a while, along with some cancer screening setups and follow up with the doctor to see labs and everything else.
Accessing quality healthcare has long been an issue for tribal nations, especially in rural areas. The Federal Indian Health Service has less than 100 hospitals and medical clinics nationwide, all to serve about 2.8 million American Indians and Alaska Natives. And most facilities suffer chronic staffing shortages. Some of the highest vacancy rates have been felt by the Navajo Nation, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Phoenix, Arizona, and Billings, Montana. John Pichon is the director of the Fallon Tribal Health Center, which runs the mobile clinic here at this fair. He says the lack of access was amplified 5 years ago during the COVID-19 pandemic.
A lot of healthcare facilities were being shut down, and with all the services being closed, we needed something to go out to the communities.
After years of driving their vehicles to neighboring reservations, the tribe bought a mobile clinic last year. It was funded by a $673,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, aimed at expanding rural healthcare access after the pandemic. The tribe's mobile clinic serves its members and drives to the Lovelock Paiute and Yamba Shoshone reservations, covering a territory of about 200 miles. It can also treat any member of a tribe in Nevada. Pichon says they serve about 2,000 people, averaging about 20 patients each month. They try to visit each tribe at least once a month, but that isn't always easy.
Challenges is weather and distance. They are far away, and during winter, sometimes these areas get a little hard to access.
Other tribal nations in our region are working to bridge the gap in healthcare access. Mobile health clinics are also being used by the Navajo Nation, the White Mountain Apache Tribe in Arizona, and the Fort Peck Tribes in Montana.
I think having the providers go into the community open their eyes to the needs and how to better serve them.
Dr. Christopher Chai is working at the mobile clinic here in Lovelock. He says they can even act as an urgent care for injuries and wounds.
We will get the random rancher come in with a broken finger and say, like, what do I do with this? Sliced open, and we can put in stitches.
Pichon adds that the clinic also helps tribal members be proactive instead of reactive about their health.
We have some people that maybe only come in when they're sick, but now they're seeing us for their preventative care when we come out.
Like Barbara Bonta, an elder of the Walker River Paiute tribe who lives in Lovelock.
I've been seeing them for my feet and other problems that I didn't know I had until they start testing this and that.
Bonta was brought to the mobile clinic by her daughter, Tia Happy.
With my mom, she can't sit for a long time, you know, in a car to go to Fallon or elsewhere to appointments, so it makes it super convenient to have it here when the mobile comes here.
Happy says her mom's been seeing Dr. Chai for the past 2 years. Consistent care that's been made possible by this mobile clinic, which isn't slowing down. This year, the clinic plans to add dental care to its services. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Last year, the Teton County School District found multiple swastika images in a school bathroom. This year, it found graffiti in a treehouse, including anti-Semitic messages and racial slurs. There's been other white supremacist and neo-fascist hate images around town, too. Those local events set the stage for a recent screening of a documentary called October 8th, hosted by Wyoming for Israel, a nonprofit multi-faith alliance that advocates for the state of Israel. The film looks at the rise of anti-Semitism on social media and college campuses after the Hamas attack on Israel in 2023. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Sophia Boyd Flegel caught up with Jewish parents after the screening to hear how they talk to their children about anti-Semitism.
Sherry, I'm just going to have it first introduce yourself. I'm going to check the level.
After the screening, Sherry Brownfield said she was pleasantly surprised her daughter didn't experience anti-Semitism directly growing up in Jackson.
There's an amazing community here, so it didn't seem to be a conversation to bring up when she was younger.
Her daughter, Finley, says, sure, Kids drew swastikas on their iPads or lockers in middle school, but she saw it as more a sign of immaturity than a direct threat.
Something I've noticed about Jackson specifically is there tends to be an ignorance. There's just a lack of education in comparison to people that are genuinely being rude.
Reading books about the Holocaust, Finley says, was the start of deeper talks.
We talked about just these people just don't want us to be alive as Jews.
Finley's now 19, in college in Southern California. She considers herself a Zionist, unlike most of her friends on a liberal college campus. She says that can feel isolating, but she tries to surround herself with mixed opinions, including people who feel similarly.
My mom is very on my side about like being myself and not hiding anything.
Like many tough topics, the younger years usually mean simpler, age-appropriate conversations. Rizzi Mendelson says she talked with some of her kids about anti-Semitic graffiti found near one of Jackson's schools.
So we include our children in everything that we stand for, and everything that we stand for revolves around us being Jewish.
Her 12-year-old, Nahi, stands at her side. He's homeschooled and at this point, pretty shy.
What were your thoughts when you heard about the incident?
I don't know.
Together with her husband, Rabbi Zalman, the Mendelsons have 9 kids. Rizzi really emphasizes how conversations about Judaism at any age are about values. The Mendelsons are Orthodox and observe a 24-hour Shabbat each week.
So every Friday from sunset until Saturday at sundown, we shut all community. We shut our phones. We shut. We disconnect in order to connect.
Nahi is a big fan of this time.
There's more family time. You get to play games. It's fun.
He and his siblings don't have a television or social media apps like TikTok or Instagram.
So if there's one thing I could suggest to people is take those 24 hours, any 24 hours, and just disconnect from the noise around.
Avi Cantor has 3 kids between 14 and 20.
We're just teaching our kids how to treat everybody as a person, as a human, to see them for who they are.
Like Brownfield, Cantor says he's not running directly with anti-Semitism in Jackson.
I never really found ourselves particularly focused or hyper-focused on anti-Semitism. We've been very fortunate in this community and the one we came from to not have to deal with it firsthand.
Now, he tries to answer his kids' questions with context.
They're familiar with what happened during World War II and the Holocaust and other pogroms and things that have happened historically around the world.
These conversations pop up around the dinner table, especially with his eldest now living in Israel.
The first blush was from a safety perspective and, you know, in those, and then trying to understand what was happening and why it was happening and explaining the immediate conflict to them and then putting that in context to the historical challenges of the region and our longer history.
Also, like other tough talks, conversations get more complex as kids age. As Sherry says, there's no real playbook.
I'm thinking through it, but there isn't really an answer to, like, what do you say about anti-Semitism as much as how do you instill pride in your Jewish child?
That's pride, she says, built over years.
Go out when you feel safe, trust your instincts, stand strong.
Sophia Boyd-Fliegel, KHOL News.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, this episode's audio producer, Jacob Hoffman, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.